This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 14th of August, 1951. The title of this lecture is Personality. This tape is 42 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
The second part of this talk is concerning the parts of the mind, function of the mind, purpose of the mind. Mind is an organism. I mean, it's an organism within an organism, which turns out computations relating to survival. Human mind is differentiated from the human brain. The human brain is a bunch of neurons and axons and bones and sinews and other things that nobody knows anything about. But the Greeks thought the mind was in the stomach. As far as I know, it still is. I know I haven't been able to resolve the get it straight in my mind where the mind actually locates. It might be operated wholly and completely from a sub-post, which is out near Alpha Centauri, for all I know. I know that if you cut up the human brain in some fashion or other, give it psychiatric treatment of any kind, it goes out of operation, doesn't function anymore. So it's obvious that cutting into these axons and neurons and so forth has a tendency to discontinue certain conduits. That we're fairly certain of. But of course, we can't be certain thought is taking place just because thought interrupts. You see, there could be an army at town A and an army at town B, and the army at A and the army at B might be in communication with each other through a switchboard at C. And if you go in and bomb the switchboard at C, then these two armies would apparently not be coordinating. So all you'd have to do is just cut out the switchboard, or as a matter of fact, cut their telegraph lines most any place, and they'd block contact with each other, and you would get the same effect as no computation. So it wouldn't necessarily follow that the brain does thinking. It doesn't necessarily follow. Doesn't necessarily follow that it doesn't either. It's just one of those questions that had better be left open till we really know something about it. Now, there are too many people in the past have been prone to close a book on a subject and say, well, that's all there is, boys. And anybody that thinks any other way after this is immediately going to be stood up against the nearest wall and shot. And it has a tendency to stultify thought. Now, the mind then could be most any place, but we can at least postulate its working principle. Mind perceives, poses, and resolves problems relating to survival of the organism along all of its dynamics. The mind, in a good working state, in good condition, has a definition, evidently, of an optimum solution. An optimum solution would be that solution which answers the major survival for each one of the dynamics. In other words, an optimum solution would be something that would postulate the highest level of survival for the individual, the future, his family, his children, the group, mankind, life in general, the physical universe, life itself, and so forth. That would be an optimum solution. The solution falls away from being optimum at any place where it leaves out of the computation the best interests of any dynamic. And the survival of the organism is lessened to the degree that it fails to take into account the right to survival along any one dynamic. There's an active ratio there. So you see, actually, education could inhibit survival. Lack of it could inhibit survival, but also inability through one cause or another to compute along certain lines would be. Here's another case of do not send a fine for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. There was a wonderful book written one time called, I think it was The Case of Sergeant Grisha, or Grisha. It had to do with the fall of the German Empire. The fall of the German Empire was postulated to have occurred with the German army's arbitrary execution of a Russian soldier by the name of Grisha. He had not sinned against the German state in any way. It was totally unjust that he was executed. Through the indolence, incompetence of various German officers, so forth. And it builds this whole thing up into the old rhyme, for want of a nail, the shoe was lost, for want of a shoe, the horse was lost, for want of a horse, the rider was lost, for want of the rider, the battle was lost, and all for the want of a horseshoe nail. Well, interesting example of the state forgetting or overriding the rights of one human being with terrific consequences, because the death of Grisha, by the way, was historical. World War I, it evidently actually occurred, and I know that it did cause riots, not only amongst the Russian soldiers, but caused riots amongst the German troops. And a lot of smoke occurred through the death of one person who was wrong. Now, in such a way, you would not think that because A denies or overlooks the computation relating to man as a whole, all of men, just on that dynamic, that he'd overlook a computation relating to that he has reduced his own survival in it. And believe me, he has. Actually, one can overlook the computation at any point all the way on up, and the solution is not perfect. A perfect solution would be one which gave infinite survival to everything connected with every dynamic. If a perfect solution ever came up, you would immediately probably postulate and set up life immortal forever, and the physical universe would go on forever. Something like Einstein's, if you get up to the speed of light, you become bigger than the universe. I mean, one of those impossibles. Just as death, if anyone reached complete death, if he died all the way, then the whole universe would die. Or if anybody was 100% wrong, same thing, you see. How wrong can you get? Dead. To be 100% wrong on a solution, it would be the end of the physical universe, the end of everything, if he was really 100% wrong. He couldn't be 100% wrong. Nothing could be. But here is the purpose of the mind, and here's the way it functions. The imagination postulates wide, large goals, desirable goals, and the mind resolves problems to attain those goals. Imagination is very important in this. Now, here's where we have something that can't be made too simple. Here's the equation of thought. Here's pain, and here's this pleasure. Now, pleasure can be defined as the attainment or the act of obtaining a pleasurable goal or a survival goal. That which is assists survival. If it really assists survival, it is pleasurable. The approach toward a survival goal gives pleasure. A pleasure which is an immoral pleasure is one which gives more pain than it gives survival. It's a survival goal which is going to cause more pain than it, and it becomes forbidden in the society. It's immoral. Now here's pain, here's pleasure. The mind works on the idea that it avoids pain. And a human mind will avoid pain along all of the dynamics, for all of the dynamics possible in its vicinity. It avoids pain, and it seeks pleasure. In other words, it seeks survival, high survival goals, and so on. You got a double vector leading away from pain. Well, it'll compute quite rapidly in this direction. The first symptom that it is aberrated comes here, that it approaches less and less and less pleasure. And its aberration, or its inability, its increasing inability to think, is cut off, dead. Now, this all may happen in an instant. An 88 millimeter shell hits the fellow in the brisket, and this happens. Or it may happen over a lifetime, year by year. A person obtains less and less survival. He attempts to obtain survival less and less. And he attempts more and more to avoid pain, but he sees more pain to avoid until he can get to a point where he sees nothing but pain and sees no pleasure in survival, at which time he will find some way or other to pass in his chips. Very simple how this takes place. Here's the mind process of thinking. Very simple one. It's so idiotically simple, it doesn't seem possible. It could have been overlooked. And yet it evidently has pretty thoroughly been. The mind gathers data. We're having a good time around here collecting. How many perceptics are there? How many ways of communication are there with the material universe? And got up to 40 without any trouble and kept on going. I don't know, there may be about 75 perceptions. Sight, depth perception, color perception, sound, tone, volume, pitch. Touch, smell. All of these things are channels by which one perceives the material universe. Muscular tension, gravity, joint position, saline content of the blood. There's this tremendous list of these things. It's the way the body, mind, so forth, contact the physical universe. Now, when it makes a contact with a sense perception, that is registered. If it's registered at a moment of pleasure, it becomes a pleasurable registry. If it is registered in a moment of pain, and don't think just because you can't remember every moment of pain that you have ever felt, that you can't, that it isn't registered. Believe me, any auditor can tell you different. It's registered. So if this registry takes place during a moment of pain, it is classified as a painful registry. If it's an intermediate registry, it is just a null, doesn't matter much. But it's recorded anyway. Here's this tremendous bundle of perceptics, tremendous number of channels from the eye, the awareness of the mind, looking out into the physical universe through all of these channels and registering everything perceived second by second by second by second. As a matter of fact, the registry is much better than second by second. It's registered. Sight, for instance, is registered about every 25th of a second. Sight is about the same speed as a Brownie camera. I know, I made a series of tests out of college. I found out nobody tested how fast sight traveled. I wanted to know why the mind found it necessary to blur an object. An object went fast, and the mind did it blur to the mind. At what speed did it blur? And obviously, the mind was operating on some kind of a convulsive shutter system if it permitted anything to blur. What's the speed of transmission of the light wave from the iris back to the whatever it registers on in the mind? It's 25th of a second, about the same as a box camera. Now, there's touch, all these things. They're all recorded. So we'd say that, you might say every 25th of a second you'd have a full recording. You certainly have a full recording of sight every 25th of a second. And it's registered, and there it is, on file. From there on out, it's on file. Man made the mistake that just because I couldn't recover the data that he had stored, that it hadn't been stored. That's not true. It had been stored, even though I could not recover it, because we have ways and means in Dianetics by which this stuff can be recovered, and it is found to be recoverable. So we have in the mind what is called a time track, and that's all these perceptions. Oh, heavens, well, how many ever there are, call it 50 for the moment. And here's the 25th of a second. That one. Here's another 25th of a second. Here's another 25th. In other words, everything that is smelled, touched, seen, heard in the environment comes in and is registered. Complete record being made. That record goes on continually, evidently from conception to death. It's a rather terrific record. It's filed according to, in two files at least. We were counting up files, by the way. It seems that the reactive mind, or the unconsciousness section of the mind and so forth, has about 20 duplicate files. Nature is very, very splendid when it comes to numbers. It's like she breeds herring. She doesn't care how many times she duplicates these files. It seems to be completely unlimited. There are at least two analytical files. At least two complete analytical files. So these things are probably not only recording, but carbon copies of them are being refiled. Intricate system, but very simple in its essence. Here's sight. Every 25th of a second, sight is being recorded on this tape. That's a funny thing, but that's sight is recorded whether one can see or not. If one can't see, it's recorded black. See, even seeing blackness is seeing. So that there's all of this recording takes place, and it's all on file. Now, this associates itself with attaining pleasure and avoiding pain. And it gets into combinations. And out of these combinations, thought takes place. The thought is, perception of object. Perception of object. This is, object is an A. All right, we perceive an A. We have 9,685,326 files which say that A is null, neither pain nor pleasure. But we have 42 files that say it's very painful. So A is something we better leave alone, even though so many times it's been innocuous. But maybe that isn't good enough. It's only when A is purple. We got a color perception that comes in there. It's only when A is purple and the odor of heliotrope is in the air that A is dangerous. And we can go on with these other perceptives so that we can get the moments when A is dangerous. Now, A is then classified, so one does thinking about A. Is A of any danger to me? What is my state of being? Now, it so happens that A is a cat. A is a cat, and there are a lot of perceptions there that say cats are dangerous. Way back on the time track, there's a whole bunch of perceptions in there, and they all have to do with being clawed in the face and having the chest set on when one is in a crib. Cats are particularly dangerous when the smell of milk and baby powder are mixed and the flavor of milk is in the mouth. Then cats are really dangerous. However, let's just change the environment here a little bit and let's put the hunger index way up. And perception of food, any other food, zero. Cats dangerous, yeah, but here we're getting back to the psychologist and the electric grill that the rat has to cross. Because if no matter how dangerous that cat may seem, why, a fellow gets hungry enough, the perceptics agree in other quarters, he'll take Mr. Cat and spit him and roast him just as quick as scat. Matter of fact, I read a most beautiful story about the siege of Vicksburg. It was written by a Confederate in the last issue of the paper printed before Vicksburg fell to the Union. And I swear in those days they really must have been up on the tone scale, because they knew that Vicksburg was surrendering in the morning, and yet they got out the issue of this paper and they repeated this tremendous banquet. All done up with this great banquet that they had the night before Grant's troops were to march in and so on. And it had to do with the procurement and roasting, the fortuitous procurement, and the Epicurean roasting of a cat. And they, three officers dined upon cat, and this was the banquet. And it was probably the only dinner eaten that night in Vicksburg. So the mind goes on, and it has all these tremendous numbers of classifications. And it comes to a decision, very simply, evidently, with what's known as Boolean algebra. But we needn't break our necks on that. It's merely Boolean algebra is a method of figuring out a way to ask a question of the material universe and the organism, which can be answered yes or no. And, of course, it falls in the middle, it's maybe. So all these things are set up. Is A dangerous? Falls in the middle. Yes or no? So, what other factors are there here where we can get a yes or no? And finally, the scanners in the mind will sweep around, the perceptions and so forth will sweep around until they finally pick up something on which they can get, is this dangerous? No, it'll say. Then they get another one. No, it's not dangerous. No, it's not dangerous. No, 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 no. And then with those, we get yes, yes, yes. But then we've got 185 no's and we got three yeses, so it's obviously no. And all this happens in a few milliseconds. The process of thought is the process then of perception, registry, and recall. One perceives the material universe and the organisms around him. He files it for future reference. And as his index files begin to build up, then all of his new perceptions become more meaningful because they are classified against his old perceptions. And then he can call these things up, and by adjudication of yes and no, he can reach a conclusion. And that even goes out to the point of getting a tremendously imaginative, creative picture of the future. Oh, the mind is fantastic what it can do. By the way, Boolean algebra, this yes-no system, is used on telephone switchboards. If you don't think that man doesn't try to get complex sometime, you ought to look at some of these big master switchboards that go into these big city automatic systems. And those things run on Boolean algebra. And you dial a number one place, and there are certain trunks that are shunted here and there, and it's just a scanner that hunts down the board and looks for, is yes greater than no, or is no greater than yes? Is yes greater than no, no greater than yes? And that scanner just goes down the board like that, finds your, just by yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, a whole. Because we've got more no's over here than we have yeses, that means there's going to be an outlet here. And it'll just plug right straight in that way, and that happens in Wichita, that happens six times for every telephone number you call. That whole search of the central switchboard system takes place. And it just takes place. Look. And you can watch that apparatus by which they will they hunt and so forth. That isn't the one that's doing the Boolean algebra scanning. That is directed by the scanner. It's way back off someplace. Or they've got some of those. They've got one of those at Ma Bell that is capable, actually, of handling all of the long-distance calls in the country. They were going to install it up here around Kansas City someplace on their new microwave system. It would search simultaneously thousands of lines for thousands of calls simultaneously without ever making a mistake, and it was all done on yes and no and Boolean algebra. So this stuff can get complicated. You can see how all thought will derive just straight from yes or no. Am I alive? Yes, no. No, yes. Am I hungry? Yes, no. It's all a postulation. Now, the postulation of the question is done by the physical condition, which was in a condition before when something or other happened. So you've got a current physical condition, and you've got a current perception of the environment. These two compare, and they give solutions. It's wonderful how this works out. Well, when there's too much pain occurs in all this, too much pain happens, the perception of pain is too great, you get... Let us say the whole mind is operating on negative charges, you'll suddenly get a positive charge on the scanner. Let's say here are all these yes, no's, and they're filed with a negative charge, and they're being swept with a scanner. All right? Only here's a big pain charge. You've watched television. Did you ever see the scanner start jumping on television? It'll start sweeping across. It'll sweep this very nicely, but it'll hit a point where I think it's a positive point of electricity. The scanner, as it goes, the beam as it comes through there, gets a reverse charge suddenly, some microscopic reverse charge on the oscilloscope, and the beam then starts skipping. And you'll see the whole picture distort because the wrong particle of charge is on the inside of that oscilloscope. In other words, the scanner, perception of I operating as a scanner, you would see, would not hit this charge. In other words, it would be occluded. So where you have heavy, very heavy pain charges, it's like having negative electricity on the thing, and it becomes occluded. And these perceptions in the bank won't scan. It'll just avoid it. But that's what it's saying to the organism. It's saying, avoid this thing. Not only don't go near it, but don't even think about it, and don't let the scanner go over it. And it all produces from the mechanical sweep of just a positive charge where a negative charge should be. So this thing has a pain index in there, and you get a sweep, and all of a sudden, you got an occlusion. You also have a blocking of the motor controls simultaneously. The second you get an occlusion, there's a blockage of the motor controls, and the impulse toward an object is interrupted, and an impulse away from it begins. That is stimulus response on thought level. Actually, very simple. Now, the mind functions well according to its capabilities in the direct ratio that its banks are open. This does not mean, however, that a person is as energetic as he is unoccluded. It doesn't mean that because all of his banks are available to him necessarily that he's energetic, because people have different endowments of life. One chap measured the brain. He figured out that as far as electrical energy was concerned, the brain was running on 2.4 watts. Having looked over a few minds, I would say that I don't know which ones he measured. He probably got an average of many readings, many places. Probability is that it goes from about, if it's going to measure watts, it probably goes from 1 to 5. There is an individual who can be tremendously occluded and who can have an enormous persistence. Believe me, he's really going in blind, though. He has this tremendous persistence. He's very occluded. And you can have people who are wide open and whose persistence is just... you get a person's occlusions mopped up, and you get those out of the way. And with this tremendous force that he has, too, well, he takes off like a rocket ship. But a person can still have a lot of pain on the bank and be effective, is what I'm trying to say. But it's only in ratio to how much persistence he has in life anyway. So you can have a person who is operating practically every sweep of the scanner will hit, look at the objects in the area and say, dangerous object, dangerous object, dangerous object. That's just his sight scanner, intervals of danger. It's registered, by the way, and then scanned. One isn't getting direct computation. It's registered and scanned. Registered and scanned. It's an indirect sight, in other words. And the whole physical universe can start picking up these things. It's only when he is unable to make up his mind. Now, this would be in a case where he sweeps over the bank one time, and it says, microphone, dangers. And it sweeps over the next tier of banks having to do with, because he's got another scanner now, it goes to work and it scans up all the whole subject of microphones, run the whole subject of microphones. Why is this microphone dangerous? Doing that continually, all right. And it says, microphone safe. Microphone dangerous, microphone safe, microphone dangerous, microphone safe. He's got instances when microphones were dangerous, instances when they were safe, and he's got the quantity of safety of microphones and the quantity of danger of microphones, and they start balancing. He starts hanging up on an overall maybe. The whole computation keeps coming out maybe on the subject of microphones. He develops what you call an anxiety about microphones. Now, the microphone becomes a symbol, too, for the address and the proximity of other human beings. It becomes a symbol of communication, so it's got many instances behind it that are highly complex. But if it starts falling out in the maybe range, he can't get up to the point where necessity level says, I got to, and yet he can't quite leave it alone. He's anxious about microphones. He's got to have the thing, but he can't get away from it. But he's got to get away from it because he can't have it. When a fellow starts to build up to the point where floors are uniformly more dangerous than they are safe, when floors are uniformly safer than they are dangerous, when chairs are uniformly safer than they are dangerous, when chairs are uniformly more dangerous than they are safe, when it is dangerous to breathe air and not dangerous to breathe air, when it's dangerous to have light but not dangerous to have light, when it's dangerous to touch anything but dangerous not to touch anything, you have this fellow hanging fire in the maybe category all up and down the bank. Everything he requires in his life for survival has 50% a non-survival value. So it's 50% non-survival, 50% survival, these objects in his life. So he'll start to balance off. The physical universe has become too painful to him for him to make up his mind. There you have indecision. Now he can start unbalancing on that where everything is more dangerous than it is safe. And he starts balancing over on the registry where things are much more dangerous than they are safe, and therefore you don't dare touch anything, you don't dare go anyplace, you don't dare go do anything, you don't dare eat, you don't dare do that, you don't dare do anything else. You're just falling down the tone scale, and death is the out at the bottom. That's psychotic. It's a lot of things. That's getting arthritis or schizophrenia. The body can go that way, the mind can go, it doesn't matter. They're trying to go on out through the bottom into death. The overall computation, then, is the same all the way along the line, but where we have quantity of pain, enormous quantity of pain involved, we get a lot of perceptions wrapped up in areas which don't dare be approached because it's too painful to approach that area. The scanner can't hit that area. You're supposed to leave that thing alone in the environment. And the first pain is the first disconnect with affinity with the material universe and organisms. And as pain begins to compound in the organism, and as life becomes more and more painful, as the persistence of life is more and more impeded by having to go up against objects, survival says, I have to tackle this microphone. And yet the microphone is all up and down the bank. The microphone is simply a symbol of death. It says, microphones are terribly dangerous. You can't. And the guy still overcomes it. He's still got drive enough. He can talk into a microphone. But one day, he'll persist, and all of a sudden, the whole house of cards will fall down. And then microphones are so painful, he's licked. There, you see, he's past that crest. He can no longer handle his environment. No longer being able to handle his environment. The environment's too dangerous for him. He can't manhandle it around. So the organism will do an exit, and life will go on and get another organism. That's the process of deterioration. Now, the stages of reaction to the physical universe can be labeled with precision. The amount of pain, physical pain that has been suffered, the amount of repulsion the environment has done for the individual, amount of rejection, brings about evidently an energy constant. Energy of recordings of pain, let us say, are 50%, and energy recordings of pleasure are 50%. You've got a person that is not too far down the tone scale. He can still work. He's up around boredom, usually. And then you start to get heavier, painful rejection charge on the bank. You see, the ability to obtain pleasure, or that part of the mental energy which can cite pleasure, is getting less and less. And that part which contains pain and which will be attracted toward pain contains more and more, until you get an organism which starts to harmonize only with pain and only seldom with anything like pleasure. That's below 2, which is the break point on the tone scale. And this is very sharply quantitative with all organisms, evidently, so that you can predict from the ratio of survival energy in the individual and non-survival energy in the individual how much he'll survive. And you'll get a constancy of reaction. Now, there's the tone scale. The personality of an individual actually is composed of concentration on one particular valence, good structure on something or other. You take a fellow who's a golf champ, his structure for coordination and his general muscular structure is excellent. He's got certain talent, in other words. Now, his nutrition is such. This will have a bearing on his personality, again, by having a bearing on his structure. His early training, that is what the whole environment has done to him, we include under training, that will lodge certain charges on the bank, one way or the other. And then you get his experience. In other words, we've got a genetic, we've got a nutritional, and we've got an experience educational, three sets of factors there which regulate what the particular personality will be. This personality can vary very greatly from person to person because the experience, the genetics, these things amongst people are very different. But we get a constancy when it comes to the amount of turbulence or the amount of pain energy there is on a bank compared to the amount of pleasure energy there is on a bank. And that's quite solid. There is evidently another endowment which is very interesting, and that is the life force endowment. one organism is apparently less or more alive than another organism. It's somehow or other a quantitative thing. I looked up in Thomas Jefferson to make sure that I was right about this, but he said, all men are created with equal rights. All men are a long way from equal, but some are more equal than others. We have tremendous differences in the endowments of individuals, not only the structural endowment, the experience endowment, but there seems to be a life force endowment. And there's a lot more about that endowment than I would care to have to tell you about in this series of lectures. We'll take up next time what has become really a backbone in Dianetics, affinity, communication, reality, what reality really is. Everybody says, let's face reality. Nobody has told anyone what it was so that they could face it up till now. Thank you very much.